Roy, welcome. This is Mark Steiner, and we're here in Annapolis at our 10th annual Annapolis Summit from the Calvert House in Annapolis, along with our co-host, Mark Steiner Show, of course, from WEAA, and our co-host, the Baltimore Business Journal. The last 10 years, we've been sponsored by Stevenson University. They're with us as well, and the Maryland State Education Association, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and Maryland Business for Responsive Government are our key sponsors this year for this event. And we always start the program off with our President of the Maryland Senate, Mike Miller, and Speaker of the House, Michael Bush. This is Michael Bush. This is your 10th year as well.
11th,
excuse me. But maybe take away a year, 11th year, and 26 years. The longest standing President of the Senate in the United States of America. Is that right?
Okay, yes, whatever.
So,
We're both poster child for term limits. The longest standing Speaker of the House of Maryland, Mike Bush.
And with that comes a lot of responsibility.
I mean, right, what here.
I'm just curious. What does that mean for the two of you? And this is not really a softball. It's a very serious question. When you sit in an office for 26 years or 11 years, whatever that number is, you accumulate a huge amount of power and a lot of influence. You call some shots. You say things come to the floor, things don't come to the floor. Mm-hmm. You have members to wrangle. You probably have more diverse members to wrangle than the president, but you have members to wrangle. So what comes with that? What is the responsibility that comes with 26 years of that kind of power without that power becoming overwhelming for the rest of the system?
What you do, you share the power. You let the power come from the back to you. You appoint the very best people to do the job, and then you give them the power. You let them sponsor the bills. They have the public hearings, and they decide whether the bills come to the floor. So you empower the committee system. You empower the members, and they do the work, and they get the glory.
Yeah, I think to follow up on the president, you have to be surrounded by good people, and you have to keep the confidence of the body. And the only way you do that is to empower the members of the General Assembly. I mean, you put them on committees that they have an interest in the work on. You include them in the agenda that you want to put forward. You forward their legislation. You give them the credit. But I do think, being in office for a period of time gives you some real experience as well. I mean, you have a understanding of the state budget and the structure of state government, and I think it's more complex than people want to make it out to be. And I think experience means a lot, not only for the presiding officers, but also the chairman and leadership of both houses. I think the experience has played a key role in any successes we've had.
So this session clearly is not going to be a session that's going to have its share of rancor, no question, and cooperation, but it won't be. It won't have the kind of issues facing it the last couple of years, especially the last year,
no,
with the special sessions that took place and the rest and the huge deficit the state was facing, still facing a deficit. But one of the major issues that you have to wrestle with is this transportation trust fund that has been depleted. I mean, all the fiscal managers are saying that within 5 years there'll be no money there for anything, and that we've been raiding that trust fund for as long as both of you men have been in the House and Senate, to pay for the government that we decided to kind of take money from the trust fund rather than raise taxes. Now there's no money in the trust fund to build the rail lines that are supposed to be built or to even fix the roads we have. So where do we go? I mean, what is the solution to this? This is actually, in some levels, almost as big as facing the deficit because we're talking about the infrastructure of the state of Maryland.
Well, I mean, Bill Gates said he could solve a federal problem in 5 minutes. I could solve it in a half an hour. I mean, it takes
a half an hour?
Half an hour. I mean, honestly, it takes compromises on both sides. Democrats are going to have to give up on entitlements, folks. There needs to be means testing. I mean, wealthy people like myself should get the same benefits as some person that doesn't have any resources. 65 doesn't mean what it meant in my grandfather's age. Democrats have got to give up on some entitlements. But at the same time, the amount of money that they came up with doesn't begin to solve the problem. So you need more revenue and you need more cuts. And it's got to be people coming together saying this is America, the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. We can solve this problem. Just as we've solved the problems every generation. The same is true of transportation. It means sacrifices. I know how to solve the problem. I can't get the votes to solve the problem. Okay? What it means is that a gas tax increase, but that only solves the problem for roads and bridges, okay, and maintenance. We need urban areas where mass transit is, the red line and the purple line, to pay a little bit more. And if you get those two combinations, Republicans and Democrats will both vote for the gas tax, and I can get people to vote for a regional transit tax as well, and we can solve the state's problems. But it's very difficult. We need the speaker, the governor, myself, and everybody on board. Everybody says no, but coming together, we can make it happen. But it takes hard work.
Mike?
Well, let me just make one comment. We've raided the Transportation Trust Fund to make sure that our constitutional priority of education has been taken care of, and we fully funded education even in the toughest of times. Well, we paid that Transportation Trust Fund back. What we haven't done is we've diverted the highway user money that goes to counties and municipalities into the general
$700 million, dollars, right?
I don't know exactly what the total cost is, Mark, but, it's like this. We're going through a recessionary period. If you were a homeowner and you had to pay your mortgage and you had to raid your child's college trust fund to stay in your house, you'd probably do that. So, we weren't responsible for the recession. The financial markets on Wall Street were. Everyone went over the cliff. Different states have made different resolutions to how they're going to solve the problems. You know, we had a $2 billion deficit, and we've basically done away with it in 2 years at the same time that we had to get weaned off of $3.8 billion worth of stimulus money. The stimulus money actually kept us afloat, and we were very happy to have received it. But once that ran out, we had to make the tough decisions of pension reform, taking furlough days, downsizing government, cutting programs, as well as raising revenues. So I think if everybody takes a deep breath all through this this period of time, I think the state has kept its priorities in line. We've continued to fully fund K through 12 education. 4 years in a row, number one in the country. Good chance we're going to be 5 years in a row.
So rumor has it.
You look in the Washington Post and you see where the other states are going with their university tuitions, the public universities, making it tougher for middle-class and working-class families to afford a college education. In Maryland, we've kept it low to a 2% increase. We've gone from the 6th highest to the 26th highest. Our community colleges are splitting at the seams because kids are going there, and we have a path for kids to get that education and experience the American dream. And that's why we have the highest median income in the country of any state in the union, because we have a well-educated workforce and businesses want to settle here. Our unemployment rate's a point below the national average. So when we had to make the tough decisions of balancing the budget and getting into almost a balanced budget, doing away with our structural deficit, we funded what I believe are our priorities. Now, do we need the Transportation Trust Fund solution? We need a transportation plan, and we need a way to fund it. But it does take the 71 votes and 24 votes in the Senate to do it. But I think coming through this recessionary period, the governor and the legislature had to make some very tough decisions, and I think they made the right ones.
But in fairness, why I agreed to it is that the money came from the sales tax revenue. It didn't come from the gas tax revenue. We raised the sales tax a cent, but we said half the sales tax revenue goes in the Transportation Trust Fund. And once we put the money in transfer trust fund, I felt that we were legally entitled to take that money and apply it to education and other needs of the state.
Which is what happened. So the question, some people are arguing that the Transportation Trust Fund, if we're going to have a gas tax, talk about that in a minute, see what that feasibility is, or any other kind of tax to put more money in the Transportation Trust Fund, some senators are saying that it should be like a lockbox. You put the money in the fund, it can't come out otherwise. We're just going to do the same thing over and over again, which is not figure out how to raise revenues and take it out of the Transportation Trust Fund and use it for whatever we need, which would be education.
That's part of the ultimate solution. I mean, to get the votes needed to pass this, that's going to have to be part of the equation.
To lock it.
Yes.
Let me just make one observation.
It's not good government, but it's going to have to happen.
One observation. It takes 85 votes to do that. And the people
85 votes to do what?
To put it on the ballot. It's kind of be a constitutional amendment to put on the ballot. I believe it's 29 in the Senate and it takes 85 in the House.
That's a tough number for you to reach.
Well, when you struggle to reach 71, the idea that you're going to get to 85 becomes a large mountain to climb. So I think we have an obligation, particularly in the Washington metropolitan area, which competes with Northern Virginia, of who's going to have the best transportation system in that area, because I think that's what the economy and the job market there is. But we also have great challenges in the Baltimore region with school construction. Baltimore City and Baltimore County have
that's coming up.
Second oldest stock of schools in the state of Maryland. And for them to be successful, they need that infrastructure. So there's two different types of infrastructure that we do need to address.
So I don't want to get stuck in transportation here because there's so much to talk about, but some of the things you just brought up here are the issues like the school construction, which is going to come up. Baltimore's asking for, what is it, $30 million a year they're asking for? Whereas Baltimore's asking for $32 million a year so they can float a bond to raise the billions they need to restructure the schools.
That's fairly accurate. What they're asking for is a commitment of 30-some million a year for 20 years.
Right.
And then to form a nonprofit to be able to go to the private market to
exactly.
See if they can raise the
Which
money.
Which they've done in other cities.
Well, let me just say this. I mean, you have to scrutinize that to make sure the state is not liable if anything happens in that situation. We're one of the few states to put money up for school construction, period. You know, the goal was $250 million a year under the COP Commission about 8 years ago. Under Governor O'Malley and the legislature, we put up $2.5 billion in 6 years, $2.5 billion in 6 years in school construction. Almost one-third of our capital budget, of our total capital budget, is school construction money. And it's necessary. You need it. And we still need more money for school construction.
But what's the argument for and against in your minds, places like Baltimore, getting that money for 20 years to float a bond? I mean, because when you go to Baltimore, and you both have been there.
You don't borrow debt against debt. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm for funding the schools, but you find another funding source. And, you know, what you have to realize, I mean, the Baltimore Business Journal is here is also. We're the wealthiest state in the union, but guess what? We have the 41, we're 41 in terms of business taxation. That's not good. And one of the reasons is that we're one of only five states that funds public schools. I mean, when I was coming along, I mean, you know, I was grades 1 through 12 in the same school building. We had to have Frank Small used cars on the back of our uniforms. I mean, it was what it is. I mean, and then in the 70s, Baltimore City, you know, had the problems. And so under Marvin Mandel, we said, look, the state's got in the business of building schools. We're one of only five states that does that. And it's good that we do that. But we've also got to bring this tax down. You know, and we're the only state in the union that gives money to the counties of Baltimore City. The only state in the union that does that, you know, largely because of the needs and problems of Baltimore City. My little county, Calvert County, which does need to get $60 million a year from the state. Montgomery County gets $1 billion a year from the state. The only state in the union to hold property taxes down to help them with the schools. So there's a delicate balancing act. We need to find money to help Baltimore City help itself, but we can't get more and more debt because it just leads to problems with our budget situation.
But again, from the city's perspective and from the schools in Baltimore's perspective, they're saying that this has been shown it can be paid back.
If the city
puts its money in, that it commits to its school system and advances that, and the state advances money, that bond can be paid off.
What they're asking for is $35 million of a pot of money from a different governor, from a different legislature for 20 years. And it's debt. Baltimore City cannot meet its current fiscal obligations. We need to find a way to help them help themselves. But you can't do it by just piling more debt onto more debt.
What's your take, Mike Bush?
Look, this to me is kind of an innovative method. I haven't made a final opinion on it, but the president of the Senate is right. They're asking for a 20-year commitment. Baltimore County is thinking about piggybacking on that commitment. So you would have to draw up in the law that for 20 years, each of these subdivisions would have to get a minimum amount of money for school construction. Right now, they probably get, under O'Malley, maybe $50 million a year. Under the former governor, Governor Ehrlich, they were getting $25 million a year, maybe $28 million a year. So you'd have to guarantee them that money, and you would hold other legislators and governors accountable to that. Then they would have to form a nonprofit, go out into the private market to get somebody to finance their portion of the match to the state's guarantee of how much money they're getting. So it becomes pretty complex. And as the president of the Senate says, you're taking bond funding that you're underwriting, because each of these bonds have a 15-year lifespan. I'm talking about it on a year-to-year basis. And now you're asking for 20 years to have that same lifespan of state bond. Let me just say this, too, in the school construction area. We give more money to the poorer subdivisions than the wealthier subdivisions. Baltimore City, for argument's sake, 93% of their school construction dollars come from the state. They only have to put up 7%. Wicomico County, 96% comes from the state of Maryland. You know, a lot of times you hear about, just Baltimore City, but there's a lot of poor counties out there getting 80, 75% of their funding from the state of Maryland for their school construction, for their education operating expenses. So we're a state that balances out an equitable education for every child.
So I'm going to encourage people to go to the mic whenever you're ready. We'll get some of your questions in and out of here as we talk to the president and the speaker. The mic is to my left. Please feel free to get up there. Before I ask a question about the death penalty, you talked about a constitutional amendment. And one of the things I was thinking about reading the paper this morning is the referendum question. The referendums that hit the ballot last year in some ways changed the nature of the game in Maryland. I mean, in terms of what was passed. Both of the Dream Act and the same-sex marriage, those things were game-changers in terms of the future politics, I think, in some ways in the state of Maryland.
Congressional redistricting.
That as well. But I understand, at least from the papers, that you're considering pulling back or making it harder for referendums to get on the ballot. Is that right?
Not making it harder, and I'm not proposing it, but there's inconsistencies in the count. For example, in the counties, to put something on referendum, it requires 5% of the population, and for the state, it requires 3% of the population. And also, when our forefathers envisioned it, envisioned two people, you know, a person with a petition, a person signing it, a person witnessing their petition. Because of technology, you have the same person signing and witnessing his or her own signature. So that was a matter for the court. It was a divided court. I think the court was 4-3 on that issue in terms of whether we needed two people to participate in the process. Those issues are going to be debated.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add to that. I think the modern technology has changed the dynamics of the game, and I think you do have to review it and look at it. I think the vast majority of people, a petition to the ballot should be an exceptional thing.
Exceptional? Some people think it should be that it's the foundation of democracy, like in California. If something goes on, you put it on the ballot.
Well, let me just say, it's much different here than it is in California. In California, they can petition things to the ballot. Here, they can only petition things to the ballot that have come through the legislative process. So it's a totally different process than California as far as that is concerned. But I do believe when they set up the Constitution of Maryland, that, in a representative democracy, they expect that their elected officials make the vast majority of the decisions. And the only thing you can petition to the ballot is a revenue initiative here in the state of Maryland. So I think you need to review it, and, you might stay in the same posture that you have. You're probably going to have more things on the ballot.
One of the issues coming, I think, will come up. We'll see what the governor says in the next hour, will be the death penalty, and ending the death penalty in the state of Maryland. You said you've been quoted as President Miller saying that you would let it come to the floor.
Sure.
So what does that mean?
What it means is that if there are the votes there, opinion changes constantly, and the Speaker and I have a great deal of power, a great deal of authority is given to us by our forefathers, and that's we get to name the chairman of the committees and members of the member of the committees, and then so by doing so, you have an opportunity to be fair, unfair, what have you, and neither he nor I want to be. Say that we're totally responsible for bottling up an issue that the public once debated for the Senate. So my position is if a bill has support in the floor of the Senate and can pass on the floor of the Senate and has been bottled up in the committee by a vote of 6-5 2 years in a row, I want to find a vehicle to have that bill brought to the floor of the Senate. I think it'll come to the floor of the Senate. I think if the governor uses his persuasive techniques, which he has many, I think it does. I think the bill will pass the Senate, quite frankly, by a vote of 1 or 2 votes. I think it'll go to the House. I think it'll pass the House. And there'll be a number of amendments. It'll be a very difficult debate. And I think it'll be petitioned to referendum, just like these others have. And I think the public will have an opportunity to vote on it in the next general election.
But you've historically not been against the death penalty, is that right? Or have you been?
Have I what?
Been opposed to death penalty.
I continue to be opposed to it. I continue to support the
That's
death
penalty. That's
what I'm
penalty. Saying.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and I continue to support it for people who assassinate teachers in the classrooms, in addition to the corrections officers, in addition to the policemen. Honestly and truly, I mean, the sniper was in my area. The D.C. sniper was in my area. He changed his clothes on my property, you know. These people in Newtown, Connecticut, Columbine, Virginia Tech, there needs to be an ultimate consequence for people, mass murderers. The last person we executed in the state traumatized, sodomized three separate women before he executed them. It's a mass murder. And he got his just rewards.
So how about you?
Look, I think the entire debate was changed when we had life without parole. I mean, you put people in jail forever and they don't come out. In some respects, it makes the debate on death penalty a compelling debate, I think, to repeal the death penalty. We're one of the few progressive countries in the world that even have the death penalty anymore. So, you know, under the circumstances we have with life without parole in the state of Maryland, the fact that I think the state of Maryland, because you have 24 different state's attorneys that ask for the death penalty or don't ask for the death penalty, makes it inconsistent. I mean, you'll never see the death penalty asked for in Montgomery, Prince George's, or Baltimore City. At least I haven't seen it done since I've been in office, or you see it in some of the more rural areas of the state. So it is a philosophic approach, but I believe it's time to take a serious look at repealing the death penalty.
You see, they ask for it in Anne Arundel County, where a person serving life without parole kills a prison guard. You know, what else do you do to the person? I sponsored life without parole. That's my bill. Because I wanted life without parole, or the death penalty, give an option. But a person serving life without parole is there and assassinates a prison guard. Or like in Prince George's County, a person laid in wait and assassinated a state police officer wearing a uniform. Or a person lays in wait in New England and assassinates firefighters coming to the rescue. And I think those are appropriate cases for the death penalty.
Because people also... Go ahead, Mike.
Let me just say this. I mean, this... is a classic part of the debate that people were passionate on both sides, just like it was with civil marriage and was the Dream Act. And quite candidly, I don't know exactly where the members of the House are.
Where do you stand on 71. It?
I said I believe it's time to repeal the death penalty. I think with life without parole and the way it's distributed, I think it's time to take that serious consideration to go forward. But at the same token, we're not going to take the bill up first in the House. They're going to take it up in the Senate. And as the President of the Senate said, there'll be some very tough amendments that people will have to vote on. Because the things he's talking about, they're going to have to vote up or down on the amendments. It's not just an up and down vote on the bill itself.
So if you are opposed to it, I mean, if you support the death penalty, why are you letting it on the floor?
I'm a Democrat, and I believe in democracy. I mean, honestly and truly. I study history. I'm a historian. And the reason I'm able to stay around so long is, you know, I try to avoid the mistakes of my predecessors, you know, wherever they are. And just, you got a bull by the tail, you let the bull go, you know what I mean?
Let me defend the President of the Senate here, because, I mean, I think he was pretty clear on civil marriage that he was not for it, but he let it come to the floor of the Senate, and it passed the Senate. And that's a credit to the President of the Senate to do that. I mean, I think it's a credit to him and the way he leads his chamber. Is the fact that he let that bill come to the floor of the Senate, even though he was out front and said, I'm not going to support the bill.
I don't know. You guys get along so well. I'm getting a little scared. Maybe I should just cancel the summit.
The
what? I think we'll see where that goes. I think there are other issues that we want to raise here just about the criminal justice system in general. The question of parole has come up. I'm going to talk about it when we come back from break. That I think is may not come up on the floor this year, but we're one of only three states in the nation where the governor has a say in parole. And there's a lot of issues around that. I'm going to raise those issues as well. We're going to take a very brief break, though. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit, WEAA, and our co-host, Baltimore Business Journal, of course, our sponsor, Stevens University. For this event, we're here at the Calvert House in Annapolis with the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, Mike Miller and Mike Bush, respectively. We're going to take a brief break and come right back, so don't go away. Welcome back. We're here at the Calvert House in Annapolis for the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit. This is Mark Steiner from the Mark Steiner Show, WEAA, at 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. along with our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal and Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and the Maryland Business for Responsive Government. We're here with the President of the Senate, Mike Miller, and the Speaker of the House, Michael Bush. And I'm going to turn this over to our audience, and as we always do, the first question out goes to our other partner in public radio in the state, Delmarva Public Radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, Don Rush here. In the aftermath of the Newtown shooting, there's been some suggestions, certainly by the governor, that there might be some kind of gun control coming out of the state legislature. And he made a suggestion, for instance, there might be a ban on assault weapons. Where do you see this gun control issue going in the state legislature? And do you see some kind of effort to ban assault weapons in Maryland? Where are you on that?
We previously voted to ban them, and I believe we'll renew that vote. I think the assault weapons will be banned, and I believe the larger magazines will be banned as well. I don't believe there'll be any major infringement on the Second Amendment in terms of right to bear arms. We have very tight laws in Maryland. We have one gun a month. We have background checks for everybody who wants to purchase a gun. The caveat to what I've just said is that we need to find some way to combine mental health issues with those people who wish to purchase guns. And so we're going to look at that area as well.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think one of the things you need to do here is review all the laws you already have in the state of Maryland and see what's really we have in effect. I mean, there's three areas of the law that we're talking about. The President of the Senate talked about the issue of mental health and funding mental health and making sure that they don't have access to guns of any sort, and that there's the public safety issues, public safety in schools, and then you have what's the real need for a semi-automatic weapon. I think even the most avid hunter will tell you that they never use a semi-automatic weapon or a large clip of bullets for hunting. So what's the necessity in this day and age in society to have any semi-automatic weapons? And I think those are the things that will be discussed. I think we'll fine-tune that. I think when the head of the NRA came out and talked about putting, policemen in every school, vast majority of high schools, middle schools in the state of Maryland have what they call safety resource officers, SROs, that are already in the school system. And I think part of that is why we've prevented a lot of any of these incidents ever taking place. Because we have taken that precaution here in the state of Maryland already. But you have to make sure you know what you have here in the state and how you can prevent any incidents that took place in Newtown from taking place here.
Having security folks who carry guns in schools, security personnel at schools carrying guns.
Look, here's what I believe. I leave it up to law enforcement. They have, like I say, safety resource officers at every high school, middle school in the county. They know exactly how to run the school, who's suspicious when they come to the school. Exactly. They're in charge of the public safety of that school system. And, I'm going to let every police organization determine what measures they need to make sure that their schools are protected.
Just a quick one, I'll get out of here. What was your reaction when you heard the news about the Newtown?
Mine was I was sickened and then enraged. And then I said somebody ought to do something about that. And then that somebody is people in elected office like me.
Mike, I was just traumatized. I have 14 grandchildren. I couldn't believe what those parents, those grandparents were going through.
That's right, yeah. So one of the things about that is that people are arguing, and we'll talk with the governor when he comes in the next hour, is that when you talk about safety in schools, part of it is mental health. And I don't know where the funds come from, but I'll ask this directly. I mean, how do you begin to put in funds in our schools that allow for school psychologists, counselors to really do the job that they're supposed to? Because that's, and also, as my 15-year-old said, she said, when I was in elementary school, they had doors that led outside. So if a fire thing happened, we could just get outside. Why didn't they have that at Newtown? Why don't they have it in our schools now? Are there ways that we can do things that actually address that without the measures of locking down and having security guards with guns, giving teachers guns and the rest?
Our schools can't be everything to everybody.
They can't, but
no.
You were just saying you're outraged about Newtown. So
no, but I mean, in terms of, we're talking about diagnosis of children and mental health and things of that nature. They have a very tough job. They do the very best they can under the circumstances. It's a, mental health is a very complicated issue, and it's very hard to define, very hard to especially young people in terms of understanding what type of treatment needs to be needed. And our schools are already overtaxed, and to ask them to pick up these additional burdens is asking quite a bit.
Next question.
Good morning. My name is Jen. I work with the Maryland League of Conservation Voters. And happy first day of session. I want to commend both Speaker Bush and President Miller for your great leadership last session. We made a lot of progress in terms of cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, which continues to be one of our priorities this coming session. And President Miller, I also want to commend you for recently renewing your commitment to cleaning up the bay and not retiring until we pass the policies needed. This session, one of our priorities is to finish the job. We want to defend the progress we made last session and also pass legislation to clean up our communities and generate resources needed through addressing bag pollution from plastic bags and litter. And I wanted to ask both of you what you anticipate this session in terms of that bill and also finishing the job and cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay.
I think the bag issue is it's a bag tax. If you go into the Outer Banks of North Carolina, they have a bag tax to for people in the grocery stores and what have you, just to encourage recycling. It's a law in Montgomery County, and I think it'll be adopted on a regional basis, quite frankly. I think it'll perhaps be the law in Prince George's County before it becomes a statewide law. I think eventually it'll be a statewide law, but I think it'll occur on a county-by-county basis first.
Yeah, I think we took that bill up in committee last year. As you know, Chairman McIntosh had that, and it was a question back and forth between Prince George's County. And it'll be back again this year. So,
thank you.
Ed. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Gary Brennan. I'm with the Frederick County Teachers Association. My question is about charter schools. Maryland's current charter school law is one of the strongest and best in the nation. It provides local control, accountability, and opportunities for innovative instruction. Recently, some charter school proponents have been talking about weakening that law, giving new authorizing authority, taking power away from local school boards to authorize charters. So my question to you is, do you support the current charter law as it's written, or are you going to be looking at changes to Maryland's very good charter school law?
I'm not looking at changes, but from the charter school perspective, it's the weakest law in the nation. You know what I mean? There needs to be a healthy balance. Bill Clinton was one of my great friends and person I look to. He promoted charter schools. There's a role for charter schools. There needs to be a balance between charter schools and the public schools. I'm not certain we've found that yet, but there needs to be a dialogue between the strongest and weakest. Both argue they're the strongest, and as you said, it's the strongest law. They say it's the weakest law. So we'll continue to work with you.
If I could real
yes,
quick.
Yes, go ahead. Sir.
Frederick County was the first county to have a charter school.
Yes.
In the state of Maryland, and the law is working there. And the schools that we have good charter schools, because they're accountable to our school board and to the citizens of Frederick County. So I'm just hoping that you maintain that kind of accountability.
Thank you.
So the follow-up on what he was saying, when it comes to education, Thornton's fully funded. Maryland schools have been named the top in the country for the last 4 years. We'll see what happens this year. And so all that is moving in the right direction. The question is, where does it go now? What's the next level? The one thing that the state has to do is fund education. That's in our Constitution.
Right.
And some people have been talking about the geographic cost of education index. Should that become law? Should we be putting that in stone so that the parts of the state that do not get, that have the greatest needs, get money? Where do we take it next?
First of all, I mean, the geographic index, it is fully funded. We did that with the stimulus money. You couldn't fund existing programs, so you fully funded GCEI. And your second question about how do you take care of poor subdivision, it's a formula-based initiative where poorer subdivisions get more money than wealthier subdivisions. Montgomery County only gets 34% of their school funding from the state. Wicomico County gets 78% of their school funding from the state. Cecil gets 62% from the state, almost two-thirds. So a lot of your rural areas, Somerset, Caroline, a lot of people think it's just Baltimore City, but it's Allegheny, it's Garrett. All those people get more money from the state than we put in. And really wealthy counties like Montgomery, Anne Arundel, Howard County are funding a lot of those because you have an equitable formula that every child gets the same amount of money that goes into the classroom. And I think that's been the backbone of our system here. And to go back to the charter schools, I think we have pretty good charter school law in the state of Maryland. And I think when you compare it to other states, you have to realize that other states have local school boards with taxing autonomy. No school board in the state of Maryland has the right to property tax. They go through their county council to meet what we call the maintenance effort to keep up with the funding allocations that the state puts forward.
You know, everybody does it a little bit different, but we make certain that from the poorest county to the wealthiest county, we have quality schools. 40% of our budget goes to the public school system. We've got, again, I don't keep reiterating, but number one for the last 4 years in a row, and we don't want it to go down on our watch. I mean, last year, $396 million in school construction, when we're only five states in the union that does that. I mean, it's I'm very proud of that. I'm the oldest of 10 children, went to public schools, and I'm glad that happened on my watch, the Thornton formula. I'm going to continue to fund it, and we want to make sure that the poor areas are taken care of. But at the same time, our state is doing very well in terms of funding education. Also, higher education. The University of Maryland now went to the fourth best value in public education, higher education. You know, I think it was helped by joining the Big Ten, but also our academic improvements over the years have just have skyrocketed. We're doing well this Dream Act. It's improving our community colleges from K through 12 and higher education. Our state of Maryland is doing excellent.
Hi, good morning. My name is Amy Chase. I'm from the Biotechnical Institute of Maryland in Baltimore. My question is about wind energy and the momentum for the legislation this year. The federal government has now renewed their interest in wind energy. There's the tax credits have been renewed. There's new committee assignments. There's more businesses than ever behind wind energy. Climate change is now a household name. We applaud your efforts here in Maryland to combat climate change and to work on renewable energy. CO2 emissions are down in the state, but we're still too dependent on imported energy. Can you tell me what the ideas or what the momentum is behind the wind energy again this year for this session?
Wind energy will pass the General Assembly this session. Okay.
I think there's two different types of wind energy. One is the land-based, which we've already implemented, and you're talking about, I'm thinking, offshore wind energy.
Correct.
I think it passed the House last year, and probably the President says it'll pass the Senate, and we'll have that legislation in force.
What will that mean? Who pays for that?
What will it mean?
Hey, who pays for it?
Well, it means everybody's going to pay a little bit more, probably a dollar and a half more on your monthly utility bill. There are a lot of issues involved. I mean, there are labor issues, labor agreements, minority ownership, minority participation, the cost, especially to people who don't benefit from it. I mean, everybody benefits from it because Mother Earth benefits from it. The whole ecosystem benefits from it. But you know, I'm not certain that it's going to benefit people in Western Maryland in terms of being able to benefit from it, but they're going to be asked to contribute.
So, let me go back to the audience. Then I want to bring up some of the issues. Go ahead, please.
Hello, my name is Jorge Aguilar. I work with a nonprofit called Food and Water Watch. That's a public interest group. I want to first start off by thanking you guys for your work on passing the bill to ban arsenic in chicken feed last year, which I know took a lot of leadership on your behalf, and I wanted to thank you for that. My question is actually related to the sort of flip side of the previous question, and it's in relation to fracking. conversation in Maryland over the last 3 or 4 years, as you know, has really centered around potentially opening up the Marcellus Shale in Western Maryland. My question is related to, in the light of new findings by the USGS in May of last year, that there is, in fact, more shale in Maryland, including from, I think, both of your districts, going down from Anne Arundel down to Southern Maryland and another one in the Eastern Shore. I wanted to hear your thoughts on legislation this year seeking to prohibit ban fracking altogether in the state of Maryland because of its inherent risks. And I'm sure you've heard it all before in terms of what's going on in Pennsylvania. In fact, I was just reading Doug Gansler was potentially suing some companies in Pennsylvania for polluting the Susquehanna River. So in light of this and what it'll mean to potentially making Maryland become an oil and gas state, I wanted to hear your thoughts on where this is going and if you support a ban on fracking.
Look, I believe we've had a full and fair debate on that in Chairman McIntosh's committee, who you know is very fair and very progressive on environmental issues. And, you know, we have a task force that's doing a study. I understand the governor's going to put the money behind that. We want to get all the scientific evidence before we make a decision. Obviously, there's numerous people within the state that would like to see that. There's other people that are adamantly opposed. But I think before you make any decision there, you have to have all the facts and all the figures. And I think that's what the governor has been very cautious about. And when we get all that back, they'll make a determination of what direction the state will take.
You know, what you have to realize is a lot of Marylanders not represented in this room. Southern Maryland, Eastern Shore, Western Maryland, Maryland north of Baltimore County. I travel the state. I was at a Farm Bureau meeting the night before last, and they took me to task on my votes for storm drainage, tier 1 through 4, confiscating their property by saying the state's taking over the zoning of the issues, all to protect the Chesapeake Bay and protect the quality of life in Maryland. With the fracking issue, again, just like charter schools and public schools, there is a middle ground. If it's safe and it can guarantee be safe, it's a source of clean energy, and we need to explore it and find ways to make it happen, okay? Dominion Gas is going to build an export plant in Colbert County. It's larger project than the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, exporting natural gas coming from other states, Ohio and Pennsylvania, and we're selling it to Japan. So there's got to be a bridge. There's got to be communication between the environmentalists and those people seeking to extract the natural gas, but there's got to be protections in place before we move forward.
So the argument being around fracking also is that some people, I mean, if the science is being debated on fracking.
Right.
But there's a lot of evidence in that science right now showing what happened in Wyoming and Pennsylvania, what it's done to people's groundwater.
Right.
The chemicals themselves being used to rush the gas through right. and to get it out. I mean, this is not a undangerous technology we're talking about here.
We understand that. That's why we haven't gone forward with it.
So at least
that's the reason Governor Cuomo backed off on it. I want another study.
Yes. Good morning. Teresa Good morning. Dudley, and I teach sixth grade social studies in Prince George's County. I received my AARP card this week because my 50th birthday is coming up. So I will publicly admit that. But what it brings to light is an issue that I'm very concerned about, and that is the long-term security of my pension. Last year, the pensions were pushed back on the counties, and I am concerned about the long-term effects. I understand that we just passed the casinos for Prince George's County, so we will be receiving some of those residual revenues, but that's not even going to open until 2016. And in the meantime, I have members who are concerned about the security of their pensions. And making sure that our pension system is going to be one that keeps teachers in the classroom, because people don't want to look for the future when there isn't one there for them. So can you please explain to us how you will ensure the security of our pension system for our educators in Maryland?
I don't believe anything has changed in your pension system because we shifted some of the responsibility and liability to the counties. State still controls the pension system. It's just a question of who shares in the payment there. That did not change the...
They're not even able to make maintenance of effort, some of the school systems. So if they can't even keep up with maintenance of effort, how are they going to be able to withstand the pushback of these additional pension costs?
That's why we give every county in the state of Maryland the piggyback tax. You can take up to 3.2% of the state piggyback tax, but 60% of what the state is for local government. We're the only state in the union that gives that. They can use their property taxes. They have an obligation to fully fund education just like the state of Maryland does. But the pension control still stays with the state of Maryland, and it's still the same pension system that we had for years.
What you were talking about though, with pensions, I mean, there's that Joint Committee on Pensions coming out of the report, whether or not you'll follow those conclusions that they come out with in terms of the future pensions. And the second part of that is, if everything is pushed back to the counties, not everything, things are pushed back to the counties, if the state can't figure out how to fully fund transportation, right, start with, that in the state all across the country can't figure out how to address the needs, the budgets of their states, and we're one of those states. Then what happens to the teachers in the end if the counties and cities are strapped?
They're going to be secure. The only thing we do with the pensions is saying, look, if you want to pay these salaries, you negotiate the salaries and collective bargaining. You have agency shop, you have binding arbitration, you negotiate these things. And if you're going to negotiate the salaries, then you've got to understand that pension is a part of it. It's as simple as that. We had no say or no control, and it's doubling and tripling. It's always saying that those people responsible for it are going to have to share in it. Now, what we will do and what we're going to look at, we're going to work with the Teachers Association, the Educators Association on this, is we have a system of corridor funding, which we anticipate a higher rate of return in pensions than there is. And we're going to try to eliminate that this year just to continue to guarantee that your pension is going to be safe and secure, and there will be a lockbox for your pension in the future.
The state still has liability for 80% of the teachers' pensions. I mean, of the $6 billion we put in education, $800 million a year goes into teacher pensions funds. And the comment about balancing the budget and the states can't, we're one of a handful of states that have a AAA bond rating. We've made all the tough decisions. You know, you're looking at guys that have voted for revenues when it wasn't popular, and people are, you know, in positions like yours are asking why you're doing it. So, we've made the tough decisions.
And we're one of the only few states in the union that pays teachers' pensions.
Yeah.
It started out with Baltimore City. We figured, you know, all the poor places like Somerset and Allegheny and everything, they should have that same opportunity. So the state picked up the cost of teachers' pensions. But very few states do that.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Love. I'm the Public Policy Director for the ACLU of Maryland. Last year, Speaker Bush and President Miller, you all led the nation in protecting privacy and First Amendment rights by passing a bill prohibiting employers from requesting or requiring employees from turning over their social media passwords. Right. We are seeing across the nation that academic institutions are now pressuring students to turn over their social media passwords. Now, we all know that students don't handwrite letters like some of us still do, and that the way they do it is through private tweets and private Facebook posts. So my question for you all is, will you join the other states that are passing protections for students in making sure that the universities can't pressure them for turning over their social media passwords?
This is a new issue to me.
I think we formed a whole committee around the majority leader who has probably the greatest expertise in internet technology in the House, along with Delegate Mazur and others, to come back with recommendations on those issues. And I'm sure we will do everything we can to protect students as well as every other citizen in the state of Maryland.
If you have one more question, I'll try to squeeze one of my own in. Go ahead.
My name is Davon Love. So my question is about the issue of mass incarceration. If you look across the country, there's increasing discourse around the issue of the disproportionate amount of people of color who are incarcerated for similar offenses to our white counterparts. And so looking at the construction of a juvenile detention facility in Baltimore, curious as to what your position is on the construction of that facility.
I support the construction of a juvenile facility in Baltimore because I don't want juveniles housed with adults. That's what's happening right now. Juveniles in Baltimore City are housed with adults. It's unconstitutional. It's illegal. It's immoral. And something needs to change, and change rapidly.
I agree with President Sanders.
Well, let me push a little bit further with the question I was asking, Davon Love. I mean, when you look at the thing in its totality, I only have like 4 or 5 minutes here, but this is important. I think that the state has always had a difficult time dealing with reforming corrections or reforming juvenile services. I would say of all the things we've done great in the state, we've done an abysmal job with juvenile services, and in this state, and that We lock up 65% of the kids that we put in jail are there for nonviolent crimes, for things that most places, even states like Texas, have stopped putting kids in jail for the things we put kids in jail for. So is the question building a new jail or changing the policies of incarcerating black children, which is what we're doing, because white kids get arrested for the same things and commit and use the same drugs but don't go to jail. But we're incarcerating all these black children and putting them in prison in Maryland. Maybe we have to reform the system so we don't put as many kids in jail. Then you wouldn't need a new jail.
I wish you could sit in juvenile court.
I've been in juvenile court.
I'm a defense lawyer. I sit in juvenile court. I see what happens in juvenile court. And honestly and truly, the kids that go to jail in Prince George's County are rare and very few and far between. And quite frankly, you know, I have a juvenile institution in my district, Cheltenham. And, I support it. There's going to be a new facility, and it's going to be safe, and it's going to be secure, and there's going to be a school there, there's going to be computers there. And hopefully they'll learn what they're not learning in schools. Because right now they're not going to school.
But the question is, some people would argue that what we have to do is have more community corrections. These kids stay in the community and are not incarcerated and put in prison for minor offenses, for drug offenses.
We're talking about kids with guns.
Most kids in prison are not in there for guns. I have the stats right here. They're in there for nonviolent offenses. They're not in there for guns. Shouldn't we be looking at how to reform the system so we don't put as many kids in jail?
Look, I think...
Is that a nonviolent...
If nobody's hurt.
Breaking the home.
Look, I've had my home broken into.
Burglaries are breaking at home in the middle of the night with intent to commit a felony therein.
You're there with your wife and your kids.
Somebody breaks your home in the middle of the night, comes to the privacy of your home. That's the definition of burglary.
And my house has been burgled. I've been victim of crime. I understand all that.
Stop it.
But the question is, what do we want to do with these kids? Do we want to keep locking them up? Or do you want to do like conservative states like Texas do, which is to stop locking kids up and kind of reform the juvenile justice system instead?
Yeah, we want to build better schools, give them a path to a productive place in society is what we want to do. And look, you know, we know there's challenges out there. I mean, you know, and you try to work on all of them.
We should start this way. It'd be more fun. But anyway, President Mike Miller.
Thank you.
Speaker of the House Michael Bush.
Thank you both so much
for being here for the 10th annual Annapolis Summit. Good to have both of you here.
All right. Bring out the boxing gloves or what?
No. I'm too old now. Maybe 40 years ago. Not now. Couldn't handle it. I want to thank both of you gentlemen for doing this once again, the 10th annual Summit, Stevens University. Of course, our co-host, Baltimore Business Journal. I'm Mark Steiner, WEA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And our other partners here and sponsors, Real Estate Education Association, Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and the Maryland Business for Responsible Government. Thank you all so much. We're going to take a brief break, come back. When we come back after this break, we'll be talking to Governor Martin O'Malley. Don't go away.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back to the 10th annual Annapolis Summit, 10 years here at the Calvert House in Annapolis. We want to thank our sponsors before we begin. Of course, I'm Mark Steiner here, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Thank our sister station, Delmarva Public Radio, who's also here. They will be broadcasting this, the Mayor's Office of Cable and Communications, for taping this program today and putting it on their channel, which will distribute around the state. We want to thank our partners in this for the last 10 years, the Baltimore Business Journal, that's celebrating the 30th anniversary this year, on the 10th anniversary of the Annapolis Summit, and the 20th anniversary of the Mark Steiner Show, all in one time. I invite you all April the 6th to join us for a 20th anniversary Mark Steiner Show celebration. It'll be the best party of the year. You don't want to miss it. We want to thank our underwriters for the last 10 years, Stevenson University, and our underwriters this year, the Maryland State Education Association, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and the Maryland Business for Responsive Government. And, of course, once again, thank our partners, Baltimore Business Journal, for always being here and doing this with us. We're about to start our conversation with Governor Martin O'Malley in the middle of his second term as governor of the state of Maryland and just finished his term as chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. Welcome, Governor. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
So you're no longer chairman, right?
Someone else? No longer chairman. I served for 2 years as the chair of the Democratic Governors, and
was honored to have been able to do so. And in this last election, among the many really positive results that the voters gave to us and that they decided, one of them was on the contested governor's races across the country, where the DGA won in 6 of the 7 contested races, including in some states where President Obama was not even able to run a, launch a contested campaign. So it was a positive 2 years, and I'm very grateful to be able to serve with a talented group of men and women who serve as the governors of our 50 states and also our territories and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico.
And you also, I think, just if I have it right, you raised more money as head of DGA than anyone before.
Well, we did.
Is that right?
And that was thanks to a lot of hard work and a lot of diligence and a real focus on the things that cut across all party lines. And we've, in a very concerted way, focused on one clear message, which was jobs, opportunity, now. Implicitly doing and the things and making the decisions necessary in order to create jobs and expand opportunity. And we found that was a unifying message and one that every Democratic governor could carry, and one that also appealed to a broad coalition of business leaders, small, medium, and large.
So here we have the beginning of the session once again. You don't have the fiscal crisis you faced before. There are issues coming up. A few want to see the throw up very at the top of this conversation and raise some other issues as well, and encourage our friends in the audience, please, to go to the mic, and don't forget when you go there, identify yourself, your organization if you have one, and speak into the mic so we can hear you clearly for your questions. The death penalty, is it going to be in your state?
You don't want to start with jobs?
No. I want to start with the death penalty.
I'll start look with at education. Affordable college. The innovation initiative.
So
moving 40 new ideas a year out of our labs and into the marketplace in order to create jobs.
So maybe it's, let me get this
straight. Mark, you know, there is no progress for that job.
Is that where you want to start? So
can I say by way of beginning?
You can.
Just by way of beginning, that there really is no progress with that jobs.
It's true.
And everything that we will be focused on this session in some way, it really has a connection to creating a state that's ever more economically competitive, ever more economically dynamic and creative, and ever more inclusive. And certainly there will be crime and justice issues that are a part of that as we seek to improve security, improve the skills of our people, improve sustainability, improve the health of our workforce. But really what the focus will be this session, as it has been in the past, will be on creating that innovative economy, because without that, we would not have been able to use the balanced approach and create jobs, reduce a structural deficit, not to mention a recessionary deficit, and make the sort of strides on affordable college and the other important achievements we've made. And if I could, in concluding this introduction, encourage everyone to go on to the state website, which is maryland.gov, and click on the icon that says goals. We set 5 years ago strategic goals for our state across those broad areas of skills, security, health, and sustainability. And some of those goals we've actually already achieved. We need to set new goals, because with each goal we've applied a deadline. There are some goals that elude us. But the work of this session will be a continuation of the work of the prior sessions, and it will be primarily focused on jobs and opportunity. So what's on your mind today, Mark?
You're a tough man to pull away from the script, but I'm going to try. Let's start with the death penalty. Is it going to be in your State of the State address? Is it going to be part of the legislative package to end the death penalty in the state of Maryland?
Well, I think that there's a renewed interest by a lot of the advocates to repeal the death penalty. I believe that if things don't work and that they're expensive and they're ineffective, that they should be prime candidates for us to repeal. And the death penalty is certainly in that category. It doesn't work, it's expensive, and I believe it should be repealed. We have reduced violent crime, including homicides, to 30 and 40-year lows in our state, including last year a 30% reduction in juvenile homicides in just 1 year. So we know what works, and we need to do more of those things that work, and we need to stop doing the things that are expensive and don't work. So I was I'm trying to recall, Raquel, I believe it was part of our legislative package 4 years ago when we came up just a couple of votes short in repealing the death penalty. My opinion on it has not changed since that time. In fact, I'm more convinced, especially given the lives we've saved by doing the things that work and reducing crime.
Are you always
going
to oppose to it?
Yes.
One of the issues I know that you're going to, and both the Senate President and it seemed clear from talking to the Senate President and the Speaker earlier that it will most likely pass both houses if it's introduced.
That's great. They, as usual, have a head count ahead of mine.
I'm sure they do.
Which is why they are the longest-serving Speaker and the longest-serving Senate President.
That's true, too. And as I asked them earlier, with power comes responsibility, because you built a lot of power in 26 years. As you've learned,
fortunately,
as governor.
Fortunately for all of us.
One of the things, clearly, you're not going to face the kind of issues we faced in the session last year. Probably will not be two extra special sessions.
Well, you never know.
You never know. If there's another gambling surprise in April.
Mark, did you think those things were planned?
I don't know.
No, they weren't planned.
I don't mean they weren't planned, but the surprise we had at the end of the last session, when everybody thought we were sailing along, all of a sudden, boom, up comes gambling.
Right.
That kind of disrupted the entire session and set
See,
everybody backwards.
See, now that's the
backwards.
First time I've heard that word so far.
Which one, gambling?
Yeah, so far this new year, that's the first time I've heard that word.
Happy gambling to you.
Which is good. You know, Secretary Clinton was in town shortly after the budget crashed and the session ended with such gnashing of teeth and disappointment. And she summed it up. She was giving a talk over at the Naval Academy. And she summed it up well in saying, she said, you know, you guys seem to have a really good session right up until the train crash. But we got the cars back on the train, and fortunately the voters helped us put this one, that gaming issue, behind us. So we'll no doubt have other issues. I'm excited about renewing our drive to create, you know, three of the five strategic goals we have for our state are related to energy usage, energy conservation, reducing greenhouse gases, renewable energy. And we're very close, and I think we will see this year the General Assembly approve what might be called a hunting license to go out and join with other states and maybe our federal government to harness offshore wind. So I'm excited about that one, and I'm excited about other ideas the General Assembly might have for helping us reach our goals on those energy issues. I'm not sure if you saw the front of the Washington Post today, but one of the big headlines was that last year was the warmest year that we've had on record. And our state is the third most vulnerable to sea level rise. In that vulnerability and from that focus, however, I think given the assets we have at NOAA and other places, that there may well be a new sector to emerge in terms of the sort of design innovations, energy, severe weather response, and the assets that we have to create a new job sector in those disciplines here in Maryland, and Lord knows we need to.
So one of the issues that is, I think, tangential to the energy issue is an issue that you have to face here in the state legislature, which is transportation funding. Part of the issue of our air pollution, part of the issue of climate change, is the amount of gasoline that we use, the roads we build to support them, the runoff that destroys our water. You saw the pesticide report coming out and what it says about what's happening to our rivers. But the transportation fund, because it's not a constitutionally mandated fund where education is, has been raided so deeply, there's no money in it to maintain roads, let alone build what people want to build, which is mass transit. And the lines in the D.C. area and the new line in Baltimore, the red line, if it gets built, where's the money going to come from? How's that going to... I mean, that is a part of climate change in many ways, but also has to do with our transportation future. And you, like every other governor, has taken money out of that to balance budgets. So...
Not really to the degree that your frame would suggest.
Okay, go ahead.
And I think we do the public grave disservice when we push the frame that we'd have plenty of money for transportation if only the lying, thieving, sneaky politicians didn't continually raise the transportation fund. And it is a frame that's out there. And it's an easy one. It's a great one. It's a simple story. It's easy to tell and retell. and it allows business leaders, it lets them off the hook. They don't have to contribute, therefore, to a large-scale media campaign to push across the truth that we have had a flat tax on gasoline for the last 30 years that has not risen, even though the price of everything else, including gasoline, has risen threefold. So it is true that we did eventually, in the course of getting through this big recession, we did stop the highway user revenue grants that went to the counties. That was ostensibly a local grant program. There's some that say, oh, that was part of the Transportation Trust Fund. But, Mark, it was not out of those dollars that, you know, the Red Line or Purple Line
right.
or those things would be funded. And it's interesting, you saw the proposal in Virginia, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, by their governor to address the same phenomenon, which is that if you have a flat tax on gasoline and it has not increased in 30 years, the buying power of that revenue stream is not sufficient to the needs of an area that has grown in population and that has the sort of congestion that ours has. So on both sides of the Potomac, the congestion issue is the same, and fortunately on both sides of the Potomac, the math is the same. There are insufficient revenues to support the things we need to do. Now, in other areas, and you mentioned education, man, we've created the number one public, thanks to the hard work of teachers and parents and administrators and citizens, we've been willing to pay some additional dollars in order to create the number one public schools in America. Never happened before. It's happened now. We've cut achievement gaps 25% just in the last 6 years. Steady, good progress because we made the investment. When it comes to water and wastewater infrastructure, we have done things in advance of other states to invest in things like the flush fee, the flush tax, whatever you want to call that revenue stream that allows us to clean up the streams that emanate from our homes and eventually reach the rivers of the Chesapeake Bay. So, but on this issue of infrastructure, we're falling short of what we need to do as a people, and it's not because the lying, thieving, sneaky politicians
let me be clear.
Related to transportation.
I didn't think I used those words, did I?
No, I was using, I suppose, hyperbole to make the point.
I understand.
That when we push the frame that the reason for our short funding, for our lack of transportation investment, is because we've shifted the dollars to other implicitly lesser needs, it's just not true.
Let me say what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. And I mean, I know you have to do it in the Irish way. You have to put it out that way. I understand that completely. But I was raised that way, half of my family as well, so I understand. But the issue is that states have not been able to, our state as well, been able to figure out where to get the revenues to pay for the things
right.
that people want, education, whatever that happens to be. So money is moved, some have argued close to $2 billion from Transportation Trust Fund to other parts of the state to shore up needs and to make things work. So the question is, how does that money get back in? How do you fund the mass transit needs of the state so we don't rely on roads and cars all the time, and we get the rail we're talking about? Some people are even talking in Baltimore about moving towards maglev. I want to see a maglev between D.C. and Baltimore. That's a whole movement being pushed as well. And to raise it. So how do we get there? I mean, how do we get there? And that also has to do with buying eco-friendly buses. Maybe we have 10 of them in Baltimore. They need to have hundreds in Baltimore and in D.C. and the D.C. suburbs. So how do we get there? Do we raise the gasoline tax? Do you broaden the sales tax? Or do you just say, no, we can't do it?
No, I think there's the problem's not going away. Setting aside the highway user revenues, whatever dollars we shifted in 1 year or to another year in this administration, I do believe, subject to fact check by Raquel, I believe we have paid back to the Transportation Trust Fund. Again, the highway user revenue grants, which some counties do and some counties don't use for road purposes, being a separate matter. It seems to me, Mark, that there's two ways you can go. And we had this discussion in advance of last year's session. One way, the traditional way that we funded transportation is on gasoline.
Right.
Governor McDonald actually said a number of things that I can say that I fully agree with, primarily that the gasoline usage is declining. And therefore, with that decline in gasoline usage from from higher efficiency cars and alternative fuels and the like, that is a revenue source that is also declining. So it would seem to me that there's two ways to go about this. Acknowledging the fact that we have had a flat and stagnant, you know, a flat tax on gasoline, one way would be to somehow continuing with that gasoline mode, the commodity tax, to be able to bring it up to keep pace with inflation, whether by indexing or phasing in the sales taxes we proposed last year as a way of indexing. So that's one way to go. Another way to go is to move entirely away from the gasoline tax and to look to other revenue sources, which will continue to grow by, you know, by population, and one of those would be the sales tax. So last year we talked about two alternatives. One was wow. That's a reaction to the gas tax. So the one way we talked about last year was to phase in, and we had a very intricate way of going about this. And every session in March, the price of gasoline spikes. It does. Every year, it does. So this is the worst time ever to have the conversation. Not that it's ever an easy conversation to have. I'm reminded of that scene from My Cousin Vinny when he's, you know, we could do an increase in the gas tax, which I know you hate. Or another way to do it would be to dedicate a penny on the sales tax. Maryland has, I think, one of the lower sales taxes in the country because we don't allow the counties to layer on a local sales tax or the municipalities, with the exception sort of room taxes. So those would be the two ways to go. We need to invest in the neighborhood of another $700 or $800 million a year. And in Virginia, slightly larger state, they need to do a little more than that.
So what do you,
so I mean, a penny generates a 700, and the proposal we had last year generates 700.
So you're governor.
I am.
You are the governor. And you have to lay this out for the legislature, a proposal.
Oh, it's been laid out.
You're going to tell us, can you tell us what you're going to do? Are you going to talk about a
no,
gas tax?
No, I can't tell you what we're going to do right now.
You're going to wait until the day you say it to the legislature?
We're still talking to legislative leaders, and we're working on a number of things. And if we're able to make a stronger and better annual investment in transportation, that too will help our employment picture and will help us create jobs. So we're still talking with presiding officers and legislative leaders, and I'm sure all of the members of the House of Delegates in both parties are watching with interest our neighbors in the Commonwealth wrestle with the same issue.
So I'm not going to beat this dead horse here, but so to speak. But you are saying that you cannot resolve this issue without some increased revenue, whether it's sales tax, gas tax, which has not been raised in how many years in Maryland?
1992
I think. 92. And so, yeah, it
when
is
the
92.
The price of gasoline was $1.08.
So
today it's $3.60, $3.70.
So one of those things has to be on the table.
Well,
right?
True. There is no way to do it without additional revenues. Whether or not we have the consensus and the will and the smarts to do that or not remains to be seen. And we're already wasting a lot of money. We're wasting an equivalent amount, or probably more, and promised to be more in the gasoline we waste idling in our cars and 495 traffic, 695 when it looks more like a parking lot. We lose money in terms of the lost time, lost productivity. We lose in terms of the competitive rankings of our region because of this congestion problem. So we've already been, in a sense, we're already saddled by circumstance if we were to do nothing with having to pay more. I'd rather see us avoid that expense by doing something that makes more sense now. Which in the long term will be cheaper for all of us and better for our economy and better for job growth.
So we're going to go to break in just about 4 or 5 minutes, but let's go to the audience first.
Great.
And I'll come back with some more questions after the break of my own.
Hi, my name is Danielle Lipinski. I'm with the Maryland League of Conservation Voters. And first, I just want to say thank you so much, Governor O'Malley, for your efforts in combating climate change here in Maryland and your work for renewable energy. And with all the momentum in the federal government to renew the wind tax credit and the new committee assignments, and more businesses are behind homegrown offshore wind than ever before, how are we really going to put Maryland in the forefront and leader in this emerging industry?
Well, I believe that once the legislature votes and approves the wind bill, which has passed the House, thanks to Speaker Bush and Chairman Derek Davis and other leaders, I believe that once we get that wind bill to pass the Senate, I think that will open up the opportunity for us to really go out and to put together the sort of multi-state and state-federal deal necessary to harness offshore wind. It can be a new sector of our economy, both in terms of servicing the offshore wind and also perhaps in the building and assembling of the component parts of offshore wind. And it is, right now, with the technology we have, the single most abundant renewable energy source available to our unique geography as a state. So I'm excited about finally getting that one over the finish line, and I think we have the ability to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question, I think, before we go to break.
Yeah, Don Rush from Delmarva Public Radio. Do you expect some kind of gun control legislation coming out in the wake of the Newtown shootings, assault on, say, for instance, ban on assault weapons or magazines? What's your thinking there?
I do. I think that there has been a groundswell of interest and desire to, at the very least, restore the assault weapons ban that was allowed to lapse a few years ago in Congress. And so I also believe that there's opportunities to promulgate, to re-examine school security generally, including the things that we can do with some capital dollars to make our schools safer. And I also believe that the legislature is very interested in tightening up the linkage that should exist between mental health and public safety, especially where firearms is concerned. So I think on all of the, I think you'll see a comprehensive bill being put forward shortly, that will address those three aspects of this problem.
Do you expect anything coming out of the state legislature in terms of banning assault weapons?
Yes, I do. I think that I believe that there is the will to pass a bill this session, and we all need to work hard for that passage.
By the way, what was your reaction to the NRA suggestion that we needed maybe teachers to have guns or more security in the schools, perhaps people who are security personnel having guns? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I visit schools pretty frequently, and there are already a number. I mean, we already have a number of officers that are deployed as, you know, in some places they call them the community service officers that are deployed to our schools and that work in our schools. They are trained law enforcement professionals who have to be recertified in their use of firearms as well as their other powers in order to continue to operate as public safety. I think the notion of arming all our teachers with Uzis and AK-47s is repugnant to the idea of the sort of more compassionate, kind, and free world that we're trying to create here in our country for our children. Can you imagine what the gun belt would had to have looked like on the teachers at Newtown in order to repel that person who shot through their doors? There's a deep sickness in our country, and it's called violence. And there is not another industrial nation that suffers from this sickness quite the way we do, and our near worship of violence in terms of games and movies and guns. I think there are too many guns in this world, and I don't see any reason, and have spoken to quite a number of very
reasonable and committed and dedicated hunters, and we need more hunters. I want to encourage people out there, if they're interested in hunting, by golly, get into hunting, get a license, and because that helps us preserve our natural resources and our open spaces as well. But the reason why AK-47s, Bushmasters, and these other military assault weapons are created, their sole purpose is not for sport, is to kill human beings as quickly and as many as possible, as, you know, effectively as possible. And so I believe that you will see an effort this General Assembly session, and I believe that we will, in fact, pass some measures that tighten up school security, the linkage between mental health and public safety, and also that restores the assault weapons ban that was allowed to lapse in years past.
We have to take a break, and we're here at the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit at the Calvert House in Annapolis with Governor Martin O'Malley, WEAFM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and our partners of all of the Business Journal. We'll be back in just a minute. And welcome back. We're here at the Calvert House in Annapolis for the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit with Governor Martin O'Malley. And our live audience. We are partners again at the Baltimore Business Journal. Been with us for the last 10 years. This is their 30th anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the summit, the 20th anniversary of the Mark Steiner Show. Our continuing underwriter for this event has been Stevenson University for the last 10 years. Be with us again and stay with us. We are also sponsored this year by the Maryland State Education Association, Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and Maryland for Business for Responsive Government. And begin our session now again with Governor Martin O'Malley. It was very impassioned what you said earlier about gun violence in our communities. And I'd like to kind of push on a little bit here. I think that there are a lot of issues. We have a lot of listeners here who but they're also attending who want to ask questions and want to get them in here. So let me before, and I have at least four or five more things I have to get off my chest for the public with you, but in a friendly way.
Always.
Let me go to the audience first. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Susan O'Brien with the University of Maryland University College. I wanted to thank the governor for his continued support of the university system, but I also wanted to hear a little scoop on any higher ed-related policies or budget priorities you may have for the coming legislative session.
Sure. Susan, we had a great meeting yesterday at Morgan State. We had higher education leaders from various colleges, universities, community colleges, all spending a day talking about what actions we need to take and what innovations we need to make and changes we need to make in order to do a better job of getting more of our citizens through college. We've done a better job than any other state over these last very challenging years of getting more of our students to college, but the challenge remains of getting our students through college. And also helping people who may have gone to college for a couple years and then found because of family responsibilities or maybe they had a couple had a child and one was not able to go complete his or her degree. We need to help our adult learners return and get those credits because there are so many job opportunities that go unfilled because we don't have enough people with the skills levels required to fill those jobs. So I believe we have an example here in our state, University of Maryland University College, the largest online university, public university in the United States of America. And they do an outstanding job, and they do it with excellence, and they do it with harnessing technology and the internet in order to personalize that education mission for every individual whose credit needs are different than others. So we need to borrow the best practices from one another and find a way to speed that time to degree and also to bring down the what has been the hyperinflation of higher education costs. It's not unlike, well, let me say it positively, that sounded like lawyer talk. It's very similar to what we're striving to achieve where healthcare is concerned. We the hyperinflation in health care costs has been a drag on our competitiveness, and so too is the hyperinflation of higher education costs. So it's going to require us thinking differently about how higher education is achieved and the public role in helping to deliver that. One of the ideas that I've been intrigued with that they've been advancing in North Carolina is the idea of early college. And in fact, I believe at the College Park Academy here in Maryland and Prince George's County, they're advancing the same idea, and it is this. To add an additional year to a student's 4 years of high school, so make it a five-year program, but at the conclusion of those 5 years of high school, a student has earned 2 years of college credit. So I think that parents and students, and there will be lots of people excited about being able to earn 2 years of college credit before you've even graduated from high school. Yes, we do have to continue to invest as a people in higher education, because the more any person learns, the more a person earns and the better for our economy. But we need to change the way we deliver the higher education skills.
Not to mention saving money for families in college tuition. If the student goes to college with 2 years under their belt.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's a huge
benefit. There's no, so, among the industrialized nations of the world, I do believe that we rank number one in terms of the expense of college education.
So let me ask this, because we're talking about education before we go to our next audience member. In the state, in terms of education, we have this new core curriculum coming about. We won't get into the controversy of a core curriculum. That's another show, several shows we'll do that. But Dr. Josh Starr, head of the Montgomery County School System, has suggested that we stop the standardized test for a period of, I think he said, 2 or 3 years. And a pretty bold statement. He's gotten a lot of flack for it. But what he's basically saying also is that we have this new curriculum coming in, but the test we're testing our students on is part of the old curriculum, so we have no basis really to test these kids. And B, that testing kids on this kind of student achievement, as he said, is just scientifically incorrect, and we're doing things backwards. So I'd like you to respond to that. I mean, because you are, of all the governors in this state and in the country, you have a huge amount of control over the State Board of Education.
Don't you wish?
But you do, more than others. So I'm curious, I mean, and you appoint the state superintendent, right? So
I do,
eventually. What are your thoughts on that?
Actually, the school board appoints the state superintendent.
But you know what I mean.
But I'm very impressed with Dr. Lowry. I think we have a great new school superintendent. And these are all things that she's working out. And I hope that Superintendent Starr will be able to work with us in a collaborative way as we figure these things out.
I mean, what do you think, though? What is your take on this? I mean, do you have a stand on it? Do you have a take on it? Do you have a sense of what you think is the right way to go?
I think, like so many things, the challenge is always balance. I think we do need to have some level of standardized tests that evaluate whether or not our children are being educated with the skills that they need in order to compete in a global economy with kids around the world. And at the same time, I'm sure there's always ways we can improve upon how we evaluate their achievement of those skills. And also, there's things we can do if we embrace digital learning that will allow us to personalize the education mission for kids even in elementary school and high school. So many of these things, Mark, are like, you know, changing the tires on a rolling car. I mean, we can't stop everything we're doing until we have a core curriculum that's absolutely fully implemented.
There's an overlap there. And I was just thinking just quickly, I don't want to stay on this. I want to get to our next audience member. But you know, I mean, if you're a product of Catholic schools,
I am.
Right? And Catholic schools and private schools don't standardize test their kids. You know, they teach their kids, and their kids come out whole. So are we missing something?
Sure. I mean, we certainly have a lot of work to do as a country, not only in the education field, but, you know, throughout in terms of
you know, in terms of elevating conceptual thinking, the ability to see the whole picture, the ability to problem solve, and the ability to understand the systemness of things rather than the individual things. I read something recently, I forget who wrote it, but he or she said that we're producing a whole nation of people that know more and more about less and less. The pendulum of specialization has kind of swung, and we need to appreciate the relationships between the relationships and the connectedness of so many things we do. And that's true not only in education, that's true in health, that's true in security, where some of the greatest strides we've made in reducing homicides have come from knowing what we know. You know, appreciating who the most violent of our parole and probationers are, the most vulnerable of our juveniles. And the same is true in terms of the skills of our people. So clearly there's lots of work that needs to be done, but there's kind of a difference in the country right now between states who have embraced a Common Core curriculum and those that have rejected a Common Core curriculum. I think that by embracing the new global nature of our economy and our world, that we will better equip our students to succeed. And part of that will necessarily mean some standardized tests. And will there be kinks in the beginning? Sure. Will there be missteps? Sure. But together we can correct these things and hopefully for a fifth year in a row have the number one schools in America.
I think core curriculum is good. I just wish we'd listen to E.D. Hirsch. He has the real answer to the core curriculum. But that's another discussion. Another day. Please, go ahead.
You're not E.D. Hirsch, are you?
I set that up. No.
My name is Davon Love with a youth advocacy organization in Baltimore called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. My question to you, Mr. Governor, there's been much contestation over the construction of a juvenile detention facility in Baltimore. So along with what your position is on that, I would also like you to speak to the phenomena of the mass incarceration of peoples of color, particularly African Americans, Latinos, being that all research has shown that racial groups commit crimes to their proportion to the population, and yet blacks and Latinos make up 66% of the entire prison population in the United States, and those numbers bear really similarly in the state of Maryland. So I want to speak to what your administration is doing and what your administration is willing to do to address that issue.
Every day, I begin my day by receiving the overnight report from the Maryland State Police, which is a collation of all of the homicide numbers in every jurisdiction in our state. So that's how I begin every day. There is no more important or primary responsibility, fundamental responsibility of government than the protection of public safety. And in fact, it was the passion that drove me to even run for office to begin with. It was the passion that drove me to volunteer to serve as mayor. And it is also the passion that motivated me to run for governor. So we've made tremendous strides in saving lives. And if one were to look at the trends and the color of the skin and the ethnic background of especially the young and poor men who were filling those body bags at record numbers 15 years ago, the vast majority of them were black. So it's not unreasonable to conclude that the things we've done that are working in terms of the earlier interventions, the much wider access to drug treatment, and many other things, better policing, the violence prevention initiative, and the reforms in juvenile justice, because those things have worked, we have been able to save hundreds and hundreds of lives, and assuming the same trends, one can conclude that they would have been black lives, or rather, stated another way, the lives we've saved have been mostly black lives. With regard to the juvenile, the jail, there's a lot of terms that get mixed up here. Let me start broadly and then go more particularly to the youth jail. Broadly speaking, for 30 years in the city of Baltimore, we had what most people recognized and all the smart people bemoaned as the worst addiction problem in America, and for 30 years we never built a single inpatient drug treatment facility. Not one. Not one. And we wondered why every year.
we had the most addicted city in America. So thanks to Paris Glendening, we doubled drug treatment funding. We were able to build some inpatient facilities. And what we recognize in terms of freeing people from the bondage and the chains of addiction is that there are various levels of intervention that you have to have, what the health professionals would call a continuum of care, from your sort of 28-day inpatient down to the more shallow end of the pool, attending Narcotics Anonymous weekly and that sort of thing. And then there's interventions in between. When it comes to juvenile homicides, we allowed ourselves to be, in addition to being one of the smartest and wealthiest states in the country, to be the most deadly in terms, especially for young black people. And part of the reason for that was that we had no continuum of care from the deepest end of the pool in terms of the vulnerable children who are a danger to themselves and others who need to be detained, up to the shallower end of the pool, you know, your mentoring programs, Baltimore Rising, and the other sorts of interventions. Even deeper than the deep end of the pool is the call of your question, which is the youth jail, namely persons under the age of majority who are being tried as adults because they've committed very adult crimes. We had deplorable conditions there. Recommendation was made, in essence, under Justice Department, I think, kind of consent decree, perhaps court order, I think consent, that we should address those deplorable conditions. Because however horrible and heinous the crime is that these youth have committed, they need to be, the conditions are substandard. And so we had thought that we needed to build a new jail. We might be able to get by with renovating the existing facility because we have been able, with the things that we've been doing that are working, to reduce the numbers of people that had been forecasted to come in there when that consent decree was first entered into some 6 or 7 years ago. Even if we do that renovation, we still have this problem. Nobody wants these smaller bed treatment facilities anywhere near them for young people. And so while I put those dollars in the budget for treatment, I cannot get local jurisdictions, notably Baltimore City, through the terms of two mayors and a couple of different city councils to help us site a single youth treatment facility in a city that still buries far too many children.
Governor, can I ask a question about this? Push a little bit on this, with what Dave Wallow was raising.
Thank you for your patience in that answer.
No. Part of the question here for some people is that, and you know, since the time you were a city councilman, I've been interviewing you for 20 years.
My condolences.
Thank you. And for 20 years. And on this issue, we've struggled on this issue and argued and discussed
crime,
this issue a lot.
And policing.
And
race.
Over the years.
And
so
death.
What I tried to say at the very end of the last segment with President Miller, and got into a little disagreement with President Miller over the issue, was why is it so difficult to reform our juvenile justice system? I look at the stats. 71% of the kids that we incarcerate are incarcerated for misdemeanors, not felonies. Right here. Right here.
What are you looking at?
71%. DJS data. 65% of the kids, all misdemeanors, others 5.8%. 17% for crime of violence, all of the felonies 11.4%.
You're feeding placements into incarceration.
Right.
That placement is not the same thing as detention or incarceration.
But what I'm saying is that if we had a system, every community said, no, we can't, we're not going to let you put a youth facility here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a treatment, probation, parole, education system that allowed kids to be outside of the system, you wouldn't need a new jail. You could take all the worst players, put them in a jail where they need to be, away from us, to be helped reformed and kept from hurting the rest of us, and really reform the system. Other states are doing it. Even conservative states like Texas do it. Why can't we do it?
Well, actually, we are, which is why we have a smaller population than projected 6 years ago coming into the youth jail. And the number that you read on placements are mostly placements in treatment. And in fact, the dollars that we have put at an unprecedented level in the course of this administration in our capital budget is primarily for treatment.
So we are reforming our criminal justice system.
Are you happy
and
with
if
it,
we,
though?
Am I happy with where we
with
are?
The pace of it, with what, where we are?
I think most people would consider a 50% reduction in juvenile homicides to be
that
important progress.
I'm talking about our kids. When you have...
Well, they were kids.
No. Well,
they are kids that were saved.
No, that's deeply important. I'm not minimizing that at all. And I think that's been incredibly powerful and important for our society. But when I think about let's say there'll be a bill that's not going to get, probably will not pass state legislature, where Baltimore is asking for a 20-year commitment from the state so it can borrow money.
Now, why do you say that won't pass the legislature?
Well, I had a sense talking to the two legislative leaders it might not pass.
Well, you never know.
You never know. But if we're, I'm curious.
Everything would take turn out if you need to what, come down here.
What kind of message it gives young people, and especially poor working class, mostly black folks in Baltimore, what message it gives if you say we can't give you money to construct schools, but we can give you money for a jail?
You know, Mark, I love you. I really do. I really do. But it is such an easy frame.
What do you mean?
Well, the frame is that you disconnected cynical politicians who are no doubt paid off by the jail building industry, even though
I've never accused
of being built.
Have I ever done that?
No.
But,
well, I won't do the hyperbole thing again because that can.
I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I believe in good government.
Yeah, so do I. And I encourage you to look into the things your government's actually doing to reform juvenile justice. And look into the things that we've been doing to reduce the placement of vulnerable children out of the home, the things we've been doing to restore the health of families and the whole Place Matters reforms that we implemented in DHR. I mean, it is an easy frame that they're building jails for our children instead of building schools for our children. And I understand the very, very, it's the best a white person can, the very painful history that that can make that frame more believable than perhaps it would be were it not for that painful and brutal history of slavery and the use of police powers to brutalize minority communities. I do have an appreciation for that. But the truth of our situation here in our state is that we have actually been reforming our juvenile justice system and social services, and we've been making some tremendous strides. The graphs are moving in the right direction in terms of increased treatment, although we still lack those smaller, secure 48-bed things that were all the rage 6 years ago. Man, lots of legislators said, why don't you do like they do in Texas or these other places or Missouri. And have the smaller 48 beds. So we put the capital dollars there and can't get anybody in the city to help us even cite one of them. So we still have that need. But fewer of our children are incarcerated out of state, you know, or detained out of state than before. We've improved the conditions of the facilities in state. We're doing a much better job of knowing which of our children are the most vulnerable and also the most potentially deadly. And there are fewer people incarcerated in Maryland today than there were 6 years ago.
I know that you're going to be governor for the next 2 years.
Thank you.
God willing, as the Jews say.
Yeah, God willing. We never know.
We have to ask you this question. How seriously are you considering the run for president of the United States?
Well, I think any thought of that would be something you'd have to do seriously. But if the call of your question is how much time are you dedicating to how much time do you spend on it?
Right?
Not really. I mean, there are other people that are paid to talk about those things and talk about who might and who might not. And I don't really spend a lot of time focused on that, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I'm doing some what I consider to be very important work that can help people in a positive way for many years to come. And I believe these next 2 years can be the most effective 2 years that I've had the honor and the blessing to be able to serve the people of our state. And I'm going to make the most of this limited time that I have, and I consider myself very, very fortunate, Mark, that I'm able to serve the people of our state, because what we've done you know, down the road they talk about a balanced approach, but here for 6 years it is that balanced approach that has allowed us to make the progress on public safety, on public education, and opportunity. So, you know, I appreciate your question, and I am humbly, you know, it's a humbling question, and I would say that I'm flattered by it, except that I know whatever good we've been able to achieve as a people is attributable to the people of our state and their goodness and their desire to create a better life for their kids. And I've just had the honor to be able to reflect that goodness along with the members of the General Assembly as their servant.
I want to thank Governor Martin O'Malley for coming to the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit.
Good
to have you, Governor.
Good to be with you.
Always good to be with you. Thank the Calvert House for hosting us, and of course our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, for the last 10 years doing this with us, since without them it couldn't be done. Stevens University has been underwriting this for the last 10 years and been our academic partner. We want to thank the Maryland State Education Association, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and the Maryland Business for Responsive Government. And of course, I'm Mark Steiner for 88.9 WEAA, your public radio station. It is yours, the voice of the community. Take care. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Malvronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.